I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
President Trump now sits at his fourth national security advisor. The president's new choice, Robert C. O'Brien, follows John Bolton, H.R. McMaster, and Michael Flynn. This most recent change comes at a time when there is significant concern internationally about the unrest in the Middle East, the Southeast, Asia, Russia, and China. And appropriately, the electorate is curious about who is Robert C. O'Brien. John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, is here to help us figure that out. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, John, the president now sits on his fourth national security advisor, and a lot of the other folks had a much bigger name and bigger circles within the D.C. beltway, so to speak. Robert O'Brien may, but I think a lot of folks nationally don't really know who this guy is.
Yeah, you know, he's pretty obscure, at least relative to Trump's other national security advisors. He's served in small positions in, for example, the former Bush administration. He also was associated with certain campaigns during the 2016 campaign, Ted Cruz and Mitt Romney back in 2012. So, you know, he's kind of a standard conservative Republican hawk. He wrote a book, which was really a collection of his essays, published in 2016, that had a blurb from John Bolton. So, you know, he's not John Bolton, but he essentially believes in the worldview of an America that is a strong leader and confronts adversaries with toughness and lots of interventionism, and is more in the mold of a traditional conservative foreign policy advisor, which is weird because that doesn't really reflect Trump's viewpoint. Fortunately, though, I think what we're really thinking about here when we talk about this incoming national security advisor is not a massive change in policy. I don't think we should expect, you know, some kind of substantive change in the way the administration approaches the world. Instead, it's really a game of how much better is he going to be at managing the relationship with the president and the National Security Council than John Bolton was.
And this could be a move that is really more about managing process.
That's very much the case. The National Security Advisor's main job is to kind of enforce or help follow through with the implementation of the president's orders on national security issues. They head up the National Security Council, which is like several hundred people in a little mini think tank in the executive branch on national security issues. So this very much is about process. And the word is that O'Brien is affable and friendly and you know, easy on the eyes, as opposed to John Bolton. Trump hated his mustache, and he was a pretty prickly guy and didn't make a lot of friends within the bureaucracy.
It seems our preliminary indications are that he has a level of respect for all, if not most, of the intelligence agencies. Is that correct?
O'Brien, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, and of course, you know, Trump has had a very tense relationship with law enforcement and the intelligence community, no doubt about it. And part of Dan Coats, who used to be director of national intelligence, his job was to kind of try to smooth that tension. John Bolton, you know, didn't have the same kind of tensions with the intelligence community that Trump had, but he did not have much respect for the usual interagency process. He wanted to do things himself. He was a kind of bureaucratic manipulator, and that's part of why he made so many enemies in the bureaucracy. And so O'Brien is much more, has a fealty to the process, and I think will not ruffle any feathers.
So as I go down the list, probably of priorities, you definitely want someone that does have some respect or a level of respect from all, if not, you know, the intelligence agencies. Preliminary indications also seem to have begun to reveal themselves that he may have bipartisan support as well, because he advised Secretary Clinton, I believe, under the Obama administration as well.
Yeah, I mean, National Security Advisor is unlike some of the other cabinet positions that depend on congressional or Senate approval. This is just a nomination by the president that is not subject to that kind of congressional scrutiny. So, the bipartisan nature of O'Brien, it's not really sure. I think the Democrats are pretty skeptical of Trump's foreign policy in general and not really willing to embrace any of his top advisors. But again, I think much of this is about how to manage President Trump. The Trump White House, especially on foreign policy and national security issues, has been pretty chaotic. It's outside the norm for how process goes. And, Trump is known for changing his mind on a dime, usually informing his entire staff or the entire executive branch or the country of a rapid and dramatic policy change via Twitter. And so that is a very difficult environment to operate in, especially in an uncertain and dynamic, changing world. The United States is facing all kinds of obstacles and problems in the world, and they're tough to manage on their own, never mind with a chaotic internal process. So this is very much about, is he going to be an able enforcer and implementer of Trump's foreign policy?
At the very least, it looks as though Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, may be very happy with this change.
Yeah, the reporting suggests that Pompeo and O'Brien have a good relationship. That's important because Pompeo is probably better than anyone else in the administration at developing a good relationship with President Trump. So that's certainly true. I think one thing that this will mean is that, certain issues on which Bolton tried to push back. So, for example, peace negotiations with the Taliban in Afghanistan or, ongoing negotiations with North Korea. Those are things that John Bolton really tried to push back on and was a sort of grating against Trump administration foreign policy. He also wanted to take a much more hawkish approach, and by hawkish I mean military approach, towards Iran. And I don't suspect that O'Brien is going to be doing that kind of thing. Pompeo is, I think just as hawkish as Bolton, but he has a better understanding of what is low-hanging fruit in the Trump administration. Where can he make progress, and where does he have to sort of accommodate President Trump's wishes?
Obviously, it's a different diplomacy strategy. It seemed to me, I always like to say, they take baby steps before they take in quantum leaps, and that seems to be, and you correct me if I'm wrong, kind of the rub in dealing with Trump. He likes to take these quantum leaps as opposed to a series of baby steps to get to the same place.
I think that's basically true. He also tends to want to reverse the process. So, for example, you think back to the way the Obama administration dealt with its diplomacy with Iran. It started years prior with covert, really secret talks that then developed into a, lower-level advisors engaging in diplomacy, and then all the way up to the Secretary of State, and then finally there was a deal. And you compare that with North Korea, Trump did a big summit that was very ostentatious, and then the details were to be worked out after that. So Trump cares a lot more, I think, about the imagery and the symmetry and the play of it, as opposed to the nuts and bolts diplomacy.
I read somewhere that referred to O'Brien as a navalist, and that kind of aligns with Trump's goal of having a much larger Navy presence. And I know that there's been some talk in the defense, but relative to the defense budget of building more ships. Any truth to that?
Well, it's not something that I think you'll see reflected in policy very rapidly. The defense budget as a whole, I mean, making substantive changes to it is kind of like turning an aircraft carrier. You know, it takes a long time. It's a big loop. And finally, you know, at the end of a big years-long effort, maybe you get substantive changes to the force posture. He may have a preference for Navy over, you know, forward deployed troops, for example, but I that's not something I would expect major changes on, particularly given that these high-level, high-stakes diplomatic negotiations and national security efforts are going to take up most of his time.
So in summary, we're not really going to see a reflective change very much.
I don't think so. I think Trump has set the tone over the past 3 years over how he's going to conduct his foreign policy. It's going to be extremely top-down. It's going to be capricious. It's going to change on a whim. It's going to be chaotic. He's going to take a lot of outside counsel, and he's going to pit his administration officials against each other as a way to kind of fight to the end and see what policy comes out at the end. So that's how it's going to go. I think O'Brien is probably going to try to accommodate the president where he can and keep quiet because he's not as high profile or pugnacious as John Bolton. So, yeah, I think the right answer is that we're not going to see radical change. Hopefully we'll get some more stability because that's one thing that this administration surely lacks with the high rate of turnover and people leaving and coming in and a lot of acting positions as opposed to formally approved replacements. And so that's hopefully that will change at least for this one position.
Do you think this has, and I know this is going to be conjecture, but I get the sense this may have a lot to do with the election and that he wanted to have that stability, more stability, and have someone that able to manage the process a little better in carrying through what the president desires. And he probably didn't see that in John Bolton. And as we get closer to it, to the election, as more and more leaks develop, which that administration is like a colander, you want to be able to control the messaging more. And it seems to me that this guy may have the tool set to do it a lot better than Bolton did.
Well, I think that probably assumes too much calculated decision-making on the part of Trump. My understanding is that John Bolton offered his resignation to Trump after a series of very strong disagreements on Afghanistan and Iran in particular. Bolton wanted Trump to the downing of a U.S. drone a couple months back. He wanted to increase the pressure. He rejected the notion of Taliban talks. And he was firmly opposed to Trump's, I think, the foreign policy initiative Trump is most committed to and least willing to budge on is his diplomacy with North Korea. And John Bolton has a long history of not only opposing diplomacy with North Korea, but preferring very strongly military action. So I think it was a set of disagreements on policy that led John Bolton to offer his resignation. I think Trump accepted it the following day and then depicted it as his own decision when he asked John Bolton to resign as opposed to John Bolton offering his resignation. So that seems to be the origin of the change in personnel here. And, you know, it might have the effect that you suggest, but I don't think it was a calculated decision on Trump's part.
Well, that's probably fair to say because it's like putting your finger on Mercury sometimes trying to figure out exactly what
that's
the
right.
motivations are in some of these
Very
decisions.
Right.
And it's been probably equally frustrating for you as it has been for me.
You bet.
Absolutely. John Glazer, thank you so much for your insight today. We truly appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right. That's John Glazer, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. We want to hear from you. 260-1870 or text 870-870. My initial reaction, I like this choice. The more I read about this guy, the more I like the choice. And I think he will bring some stability and sense of calm to the administration and not be as combative. There's this old adage, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And maybe sometimes alternative measures are not being ultimately reflected upon because one's own personal ideology stands in the way. And it seems as though that may have been the source of the friction between John Bolton and President Donald Trump. Love to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. Robert C. O'Brien is the new National Security Advisor. He follows John Bolton, H.R. McMaster, and Michael Flynn. A number of text messages coming in talking about one of the comments that John Glazer made where this whole national security advisor role has been chaotic, and some of the foreign policy has been different, chaotic as well. The President Trump's approach is very capricious, chaotic, and top down. There's no doubt about that. It doesn't flow from the bottom up. He does not have a sense of confidence in the bureaucracy. And that may be for good reason or not, I'm not sure. But the reality is, I think when we look at some of the frailties and the misgivings and the failures that we've had in the past from a foreign policy standpoint, I guess you could make a case for that. You could also make a case that obviously maybe it should be somewhere in the middle and not as capricious as has been done by the president. Obviously, you don't want to see a foreign policy tweeted, and I'm all in on that one. It's because of the detrimental effects that it may have, because you don't get to have a full-fledged conversation and revealing all of the nuances of what it is that you're trying to do. You do those in private conversations with foreign diplomats and foreign leaders, and oftentimes we're often running down a path that we didn't even intend to go on the path because we're revealing some of what we're thinking about in a tweet. And unfortunately, Twitter does not align itself very well to complex issues. I think we can all agree on that, right? So that I think is a fair characterization. But by the same token, the foreign policy of a number of previous presidents to go along to get along is not a good, sound foreign policy either. And in many respects, that's what we did. And it didn't get us much. If you're just buying time and you continue to buy time and you're not resolving the underlying friction that exists in the hopes that it's just ultimately going to go away, you know, in Iran, I think, is a classic example. It's a terrorist regime. It has financed as maybe more terrorist activities throughout the world than any other country in the world. Now, for some, that may be hard to believe. But there is a plethora of data to support that proposition. And I know that Robert C. O'Brien was one who believes that Iran is a significant terrorist regime, a significant player in the financing and funding, planning of terrorist activities around the country. All the while, when we have this treaty that leaves all kinds of space for them to continue their activities and never run afoul or violate this agreement. And that in and of itself, in the minds of many, was very problematic. Yes, it may have focused on nuclear capability, but as our previous guest, Jim Carafano, pointed out, and do what? And do what with it? Sure, there's a desire to minimize the capabilities that are out there, certainly with a terrorist regime, but at what cost? And is there any really meat on the bones? And I think for many political leaders, it politically felt good because we could say we had one with this go along to get along diplomatic strategy. But when you look at the underlying empirical data, what does it reveal? Are you actually getting what you bargained for? And I think in many respects, a lot of learned individuals have assessed it, evaluated it, looked at it, studied it, and said, no, we're not. And in fact, we've created a culture and an environment for them to continue to do things under the auspices of though that they've really given us what we want and what we've bargained for. And it was a wink, wink deal. And we see that right now revealing itself in Yemen. And we need not look very far. Now, who's to blame for Yemen and where did it start? And that's what we keep hearing about this situation with the friction with Iran. Well, who started this? Well, it was President Trump when he decided that he no longer wanted to be in the Iran deal. As I recall, he actually campaigned on that. And you can say a lot of things about this president, but he attempts to deliver on his campaign promises. I know that that's a novel idea to many folks, that what you actually campaign on, you're actually going to deliver. In fact, I was kind of chuckling last night as I was watching the interview, I forgot the late night talk show host of Elizabeth Warren, where he asked her the question six ways from Sunday. Stephen Colbert, does this mean a tax increase to the middle class? She never answered the question. If she didn't look like Tiny Tim tiptoeing through the tulips, nobody did. And she worked a 3.5-4 minute response and completely avoided the question. Why? I think we all know why. You can say what you want about Bernie Sanders. At least he said, yes, it's going to. It's the only way. There's no other way to finance it. But she's not willing to say that at this point in time because she knows that that's going to deflate whatever momentum that she has going on at the present time. So these issues of what makes people ultimately feel good about where they think they are, but where you think you may be and where you actually are, don't align with one another. And if you want to keep lying to yourself and convincing yourself that that's all fine and dandy, that's great. But what do you ultimately really have? And what we have in this situation was Iran continuing to finance terrorist activities around the world. Plain and simple. They gave a little to get a lot. We gave a lot to get very little. And that was a diplomatic outcome in that respect. There's still a lot of disagreement on that. I happen to fall on the side, long before Trump ever said it, in looking at this deal, that I did not think this was a good deal. I would agree with John Bolton. I would not sit down at Camp David with the Taliban. Not now, not ever. The optics of it are horrible. And I don't know that I'd want to invite them to our country, period. For what? Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as a memory of 9/11? No. No, thank you. Don't need it, don't want it, don't want to do it. Doesn't mean I'm not going to talk to them, but it's the same approach as it relates to Iran. These are terrorists. We know what their modus operandi is. We know what their desires are. We know where they want all of this to ultimately end up. And no matter what they do or say, are what short-term concessions that they ultimately make. In the long term, we know they're always coming back to their ideological bent. Now, how do we square that up, going back in history and looking at it and saying, it always comes the full circle. They're coming back to what they ultimately believe in. And that's death and destruction to Westerners. They don't want us. They don't like us. They never will. And we're not going to make them like us. And they're not influenced by money. And those traditional approaches to deal with these folks are not going to move the needle one way or the other. I want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text us at 870-870. We'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. We're back. We'll go to the talk lines. Larry out in Houston. What say you, Larry?
Hey, how's it going?
Larry, how's the weather out there?
It's kind of flooding up in my parking lot by my, the street by my yard, my house. But it ain't, really, I think it was more like east of us, Beaumont and Orange is really getting it. But it's still raining.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of reports from out that way that the, in fact, one of the mayors south of you said that this is makes Barry look like a thunderstorm.
Well, it's always south of us, like Galveston and Freeport and all that. That's close to the beach, that's close to the Gulf. It's always, it's really like New Orleans, a bowl, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, didn't mean to deflect from your question, but I was curious what you were experiencing out there.
Well, it's just like I said, streets, little street flooding, steady rain, but we're used to that.
Yep.
Real used to it.
Well, back, what I was gonna say, back to the issue at hand.
Those on the right, y'all love war. You know, I'm a combat vet, got two kids that went to war.
But I'm not advocating
people
war.
Be hollering. People, well, I mean, if they messing with Iran, that's what's going to happen. If, what do you think if y'all go, they go strike Iran? What are they going to do? Just take it? Trump should have never got out that deal. Reason why I tell you this, at least they was letting inspectors go in there and inspect him.
But what did it give? What did it give for us? And you're a military guy, so you'll know. What did
well,
it give?
You know.
What did it give for to us as it relates to their financing of terrorist activities around the world?
They got other countries that can go do that. America got to stop playing like they the daddy of everybody.
But Iran was doing it. I mean, you know, so
Iran. Like I've been in that region. All these countries out there: Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, they all got terrorist regimes because the culture is with them. It's one religious group fighting against the other religious group. And they have their little terror. Even Saudi Arabia. People all forget that most of the hijackers in 9/11, they were Saudis.
Mm-hmm. No, we
they
don't
were
think,
Saudi Arabians.
I,
you know what I'm saying?
I don't forget, but I don't think it was a state-sponsored event.
Oh, well, I tell you what, Saudi is not that good either. I mean, you know, like I said, I was up in Kuwait, and the stuff they did that I was seeing over there when I was in there before the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to, as a nation, first of all, if them people want to become nuclear, who are we to say they can't come become nuclear?
Well, that was what the whole Iran deal was about.
All right. Israel nuclear. Nobody says nothing about that.
Well, because they're our ally and they're a democracy.
Oh, so because, well, okay, but so since they are ally of us, at the
yeah,
same
but
thing that Iran.
But it's their form of Iraq. Government. I mean, it's their form Iraq. Of government. It's their history. It's the manner in which they've conducted themselves diplomatically over the years. I mean, it's not just simply to say that they're our ally. They're our ally for a whole host of reasons, but they're one of our closest allies because their form of government and structure and governance is probably closer to ours than most.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It might be because I look at a lot of stuff they do also. But like I said, Iraq was real good with us when we was mad with Iran for the hostage taking. And then when they got mad with Saddam, they sent us over there again talking about weapons of mass destruction. They still trying to find the weapons.
There's no doubt that there was shoddy intelligence on a lot of that stuff. I agree.
But
that's happened under multiple administrations, not one party or the other.
With you. I agree with you, but let me tell these people about being in war. They think 9/11 is bad. Imagine 9/11 every day.
I do not want to go to war.
Every day.
I do not want to go to war. I agree with President Trump. I would love to get out of Afghanistan. I don't know, though, how we do it in a meaningful way where we don't suffer a reduction in the safety and security to our homeland without having, and you're going to understand exactly what I'm saying, about some kind of forward position intelligence gathering so that we can have our finger on the pulse of what's going on there and not be caught off guard and by surprise yet again.
I'll be honest with you. No, the best thing for, people don't want to say it, but the best thing for them to do is stay over there. Just like we stayed in Korea, just like we stayed in Japan after war. The best thing for them to do, they don't want these other terrorist regimes moving in and try to make a democracy out of their country. They would have to stay there and just, you're going to still have their problems, but they need to go ahead and get with Pakistan so Pakistan could stop running they could stop running across the border.
Yeah.
But I ain't going to lie to you. They ain't got no easy way to say, we can leave and then nothing going to happen. You're going to go back to the same thing. It's not worse.
No, I understand it. It's frustrating. And
it's not worse.
It's difficult to put all the pieces and parts together and understand what it is that we're actually trying to accomplish when we look operationally as to how we're approaching some of these issues. And I have to say, in government, foreign policy is one of the things that has always mystified me, that I just seem to never be able to get my finger or my hands around it totally. And it continues to do so even more so today than probably ever before. Larry, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Will on line 2. What say you, Will?
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I have one question.
Mm-hmm.
If Trump policy and strategy is so correct with Iran, why aren't our allies with us on this?
Well, because they don't believe the same. They're not reading the same fact sheet as we see, and what we say are the facts as it relates to Iran and what they're accountable for. And so that has had a trickle-down effect as to them not supporting a lot of the sanctions and a lot of what we continue to do with our aggressive sanction policy that we're having. And it's plain and simple. It's going to be interesting to see what the reaction is going to be for more economic sanctions and whether or not there's going to be more than just Britain that's going to be really on board with us of some of the major powers. Interesting to see what the French will do. I don't think China and Russia is ever going to be on our side on this issue.
That's what I was about to say. As long as Russia and China's out there, the sanctions will never, never work. They're not going to allow it to work. All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Not a problem, Will. Thanks for calling. We got to get to a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back, and we'll go back to the talk lines. Jack on the causeway. What say you, Jack?
Hey, Newell, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Love your show. Just wanted to, expand on the idea that you were talking about with the Taliban coming to Camp David for discussions.
Yep.
There's a lot of things that I agree with that Trump does, and there's a lot that I don't, but I was just shocked that was even going to potentially take place. And, this is a really tough thing to say, and I'd love to hear your comments on it. But, when the Taliban came onto the scene, nobody knew about them until September 11th. Or at least I didn't. I shouldn't say that, but most of the world didn't. And it seems like their only goal in life is to eradicate Western civilization. So, I don't use these words lightly, but there really is no negotiating with a group like that. Our goal should be eradication of the Taliban, plain and simple, because if we don't, it's just going to continue to grow with that overall goal of really killing us in the end. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more of your thoughts on that.
Well, Jack, I agree. I mean, part of the problem is the Taliban has aligned themselves with Al-Qaeda. Okay, so Al-Qaeda was the one that was responsible. And they will not reject al-Qaeda. And when we look at what we were dealing with from a terrorism standpoint, the policies that we had in the aftermath of 9/11 was dealing with al-Qaeda, or Core AQ, is how it was referred to. It was a threat from afar. And then when we're dealing in Afghanistan, the Taliban has aligned themselves with al-Qaeda. They become more aggressive as it relates to their terrorism activities, which is a huge problem. And I just think the optics about having any of these terrorist groups come to Camp David, come to our soil, and negotiate with us, in foreign diplomatic relations and all of that, a lot of that is about optics. These are optics that I, for one, as a U.S. citizen, am not comfortable with. I don't think that we should be inviting them to the United States, because I really don't believe that the outcome is going to be what we think it's going to be with these folks, because these groups are fragile. Their leadership is fragile. If there's a sect of that group that doesn't like the fact that they're sitting down and negotiating with the U.S., what do? They kill them. And, you know, they get somebody else in there. So in my view, a lot of whatever they're going to ultimately get down on paper, and maybe it's a short-sighted view, I don't know, I'm not an expert in this field, but I know more than most, is not worth the paper it's written on. And we're not going to be able to be in a position to take that to the bank. Much the same way as the situation in Iran. They're a terrorist regime, plain, simple. That's all they are, and that's what they've been for a long time. We tried in Iran, if you recall, you know, when the Shah was overthrown back in 79, I believe, we were the ones that were supporting that Shah. We were the ones that were uplifting that government there. And then when it tumbled hard. Because we took a lot of missteps in that relationship as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.